You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
So when Gil asked me to do this class, I was thinking, what is the best way to approach this subject? And I wanted to initially talk about how various images of Christ throughout time change and how they actually reflect what culture they're coming from. Being an art historian, that's sort of my pocket. So with that, I thought that I would start with the birth of Christ. This is a piece that is Roman. It was done in 30 AD, and it was, so it's about the same time as when Christ was living, okay, approximately. And so so this was the style of the Roman Empire of the time. And this particular piece, given that it's Roman, was politically motivated. It is a piece of political propaganda. It was actually on a monument that Augustus made for himself, which was a monument to peace. It was called the Ara Pacis. And it was dedicated to this period called the Pax Romana at the beginning of the first century, where all of the overseas wars and the conquests of the Roman Empire had actually, you know, pretty much solidified for like a period of about 90 years. Not that the Romans never fought again, of course. But so that is what sort of is behind here. And I say that it's a piece of political propaganda because Augustus was intentionally evoking another time, which is directly taken from 5th century Athens, from the Parthenon. If you look at this figure, I would imagine that all of y'all are very familiar with a type of figure like this, you know? That it's something that artists throughout history have really gone back to, especially in academic painting and the Renaissance, et cetera. And so I'll be talking about that. But here you have this pagan god, Tellus, a mother god. And the way that the figure is actually executed is directly quoted from the Parthenon, particularly an artist whose name was Phidias. And so in art historical terms, we call it Phidian drapery, which is basically the first, it's a transparent type of drapery so that you can actually see the flesh, the body beneath. Very humanistic, okay? Not only that, it's constructed using something that is evocative of the Platonic ideal. It's intended to, one, be perfect, okay? So it's aspirational. It's something that we are, it's like coming from the realm of ideas. And so the artist actually uses a mathematical formula in order to construct the figure, and that mathematical formula is called the golden mean. The other thing about Phidian and the classical idea is that it has something that is called classical calm, because they thought that as a, you know, a perfect human being would be completely in control and balanced of their intellect and their desire. He said this, Plato said this way before Freud, but anyway, there you have it. So the other thing that's happening here is the Greeks really had this thing that's called the commensurability of parts. So in Greek art, you would never see just a bust. They would never chop something off a human figure because everything is supposed to come together to create a united whole. And so compositionally, you know, I'm looking at this compositionally, it's a triangular composition. Everything kind of swoops up. It is a very compact whole, okay? So this was the type of work that was part of the Roman Empire. This was, I failed to mention, Augustus' political propaganda, he was intentionally trying to equate his reign with that of Periclean Athens, 5th century Athens, which was considered to be sort of a high point of culture. And European art history goes back to Greece for that reason. So when Gill looked at this, he saw it as very earthly, very sensual, very much about the abundance of the earth. And that definitely goes along with this pagan ideas. Okay, so this is what was going on during the life of Christ. This image, which is very kind of hard to read, but this is one of the earliest images that we have of the life of Christ. And it's coming from a city that's called Dura Europus, which is in modern Syria. And it is, it's one of the healings. It's like one of the first images that we have of Christ. Clearly, this artist is not coming from the classical tradition. More than likely, whoever did this image was coming from a Jewish background, and the Jewish people had a tradition of being aniconic, or not having physical representations, because of the second commandment. So, you know, so that this artist is coming from a tradition, coming from an area in the world that did not have this steeped in classical type of prototype interest that they're looking at. Okay. All right. So, sure. Okay.
Yeah, this is going to be the
this
least.
Is the least. Okay. So, this is a man carrying his bed here. So he, you know, it's so that is what is here, and this is a bed that's here, and I would imagine this is Christ. Who had said, you know, take up your bed and walk. Okay. That's okay. If you have any questions, please stop me.
Do you have a sense of when that was made?
This was in the second century. Okay. So Dura Europus, it's archaeologically very significant because there's the earliest house church that is there. It actually has a baptismal font. And then there's also a synagogue. That they found that also has some fresco paintings as well, which is kind of different for the Jews. This is anonymous. No one knows who did this. Okay, so now we're back in Rome. Okay, and this is in the catacombs, and it is dated in the 4th century, so in the 300s. There are numerous paintings like this of Christ as the Good Shepherd. So when Christianity, early on, when Christianity was a peasant religion for the most part, the image that they chose to represent Christ was also a peasant, a farmer, a calf bearer. But if you look at this, it's definitely coming. It's in Rome. So this person, whoever painted this, we don't know who painted it, but whoever painted this clearly was trained in a figurative tradition, which is not the case here, not a figurative tradition, had some sort of classical prototype. We have many, many images from the Hellenistic world of a calf, what's called a calf bearer. And there are many images like this. But the artist here, he's got something that's called the contrapposto, which is this movement that's part of classical art. You have schiografia, which means that there's modeling in the flesh, so that you have like a, you know, this idea of a physical body here. So that is coming. This is the point that I'm trying to make is, not only is it informed by this Greco-Roman tradition that I'm talking about previously, but now that it's being used to represent Christ, and that early on Christ was represented as a poor person, and most of his followers were the poor. Then we get to this. So this is after Christianity had actually become the state Roman religion. It is not until Christianity becomes part of the state Roman, the official Roman religion, that Christ is actually represented on a throne as a Roman emperor with, you know, with his followers. This is kind of taken from an ancient tradition of a teacher and the followers, in between a philosopher and follow, like from the pagan tradition here. But this is Christ. It's in Rome. It is in a church that's called Santa Prudenziana. And it is, it's coming from the Book of Revelation. And it's an image of the New Jerusalem with the four figures of the evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And this cross oftentimes is represented in art. It is, it's was thought to have been recovered by, you know, some Roman leaders, and kind of had this old, very medieval story about the true cross that many of you might know, but this jeweled cross. So, again, we didn't have a figure of Christ as this ruler until it actually became the state Roman religion. Yes?
So I've always heard that the catacombs are filled with Jesus as the shepherd, and then the cross representations, and then the cross representation comes along in the late 300s, early 400s, something like that.
Exactly.
Constantine was 325. Constantine, the Roman emperor, who converted to Christianity, so for the first time, Christianity had the imprimatur of the state.
Yes. Significant change of what Christianity, what looked like, and physically what was happening, you know, in terms of everyone was meeting in private, in people's homes, etc. Does anybody else have a question?
Just because this will come later, Revelation 4, image of the New Jerusalem, or peek into the heavens, where you've got the 24 elders and the four winged creatures who became the symbols of the, like Gumby said, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which are on our pulpit, by the way, where this is Matthew, the figure of a man, Mark, the lion, Luke, the
ox,
the ox, which is kind of symbolic of the sacrifice, and then John, the eagle. And those will come up again. It's just kind of interesting to kind of have that. And it's all out of Revelation 4 and 5. Just kind of pull that in there a little bit. Yeah, that's lots more thoughts, but I'm going to...
Go ahead.
No, I'm going to reserve, because we got, to my eye, because I'm northern, better slides coming. So.
Yes, I'm about to explain what I'm talking about with that. Okay, so then the Roman Empire falls, and it's split. So that happens in the 5th century. It's split. Well, actually, the western section of the empire falls into disarray with all of these various Germanic, they call them invasions, but they were they're migrations. More than likely, there was also some sort of climate change also that was kind of propelling this migration that initiated in China with Mongols and kind of went through. So, so the western section of the Roman Empire kind of falls into what historians like to call the Dark Ages, which is kind of not a very nice term, but and then the eastern section.
Enlightenment and the Light Ages name the Dark Ages.
Right? Yes.
That's right. The victors get to name the age.
They get the name. But the eastern section of the Roman Empire will persist for all the way up until 1453 is the end of the Byzantine Empire, so a very long time. So this particular image is coming from the eastern section of the Roman Empire. And it is actually, the type of style that we're looking at here is called Byzantine, okay? So early on, when artists began to represent Christianity at this break of the Roman Empire, even if an artist was living in Italy, they were making decisions not to evoke any kind of pagan representation. The architecture, for instance, they did not choose a pagan temple in order to create a church, but they chose a basilican type of architectural form. The artists are choosing not to represent things in that classical, very humanistic, very physical way, but instead they devise this type of style that is called the Byzantine style, which is intentionally using abstraction in order to move away from the physical. And it's often it's called hieratic. So we no longer really have the skiographia, we don't have shadows, we don't really have physical forms that are natural. This thing is called the hinge of this, the movement here is not natural. Christ is flattened out. Oftentimes in the Byzantine work, they're very elongated. He is surrounded by this aura, which is called a mandorla, which will be adapted. The gold background is also intentionally not supposed to represent anything physical. So oftentimes my students will look at work like this and they'll say, well, they just didn't know what they were doing. They're just not very good at it. And that is not the case. You know, it's like that they are intentionally trying to distance themselves from the classical. So this is a depiction of the Transfiguration. So you have Christ here with Moses and Elijah on either side, Moses and Elijah, and then James, John, and Peter are surrounding him. And the disciples are actually in this position, which is called the Oran position. And in evangelical churches, you'll see people, or sometimes in our church, you'll see people with their hands raised, and that is an indication of allowing for the Holy Spirit to enter in. This particular piece is actually on Mount Sinai. It's in a monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. So it is clearly in this Orthodox region. So the Byzantine Church, which will become the Eastern Orthodox Church, there will be a split that I'll talk about a little bit. But they will maintain this type of representation so that if you're driving down Claremont Avenue and you look over to the Greek Orthodox Church, you'll see a Byzantine representation that is coming from this very early time period.
Is that a mosaic?
It is a mosaic. It is. Thank you for pointing. Yes.
So is that, you said they're moving away from the physical, or are they trying to emphasize the spiritual?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that we're not brought back, you know, we're trying to move towards the spiritual. And abstraction is often used in that. And in the Muslim and Islamic religion, it's aniconic. There's no physical representation. And typically they're very, very complex type of images that are either geometric or foliate designs. And it's supposed to evoke the viewer to the infinitesimal quality of God.
And so that's why they don't represent Muhammad.
No. And iconic. Yes.
Because they're trying to draw us out of
this
world.
We actually have a couple, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the church you just mentioned is the Russian Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Greek Orthodox down on 3rd Avenue South, whatever, inside of that church. I mean, it's just an amazing view, and it all looks like that to me. So
I mean, it's, you know, this is a prototype that will be copied over and over and over again. Okay, so, oops, going the wrong way. All right, so this is another Greek Orthodox image, and it is from Greece, and it is also a mosaic. And this is coming from the 11th century. And one of the interesting things, I mean, it is very flat, as you can see. The Virgin Mary typically is represented in this way with this. She oftentimes will have something that's called pathos or sorrowful look upon her face, even at the very beginning, even when she's represented with the child. But it's intentionally non-physical. So Mary and John here are the two that are being represented. The crucifixion is very rare to see a crucifixion image until about 1000. There are few. A very early one, which I found out in preparation for this, is actually understood to be a graffiti presentation, and it actually represents Christ. There's a crucified body, but it actually has the head of a donkey on it, because the reading that I read is that the Romans and the early people in the Roman Empire thought that it was completely foolish and ridiculous that a God would actually suffer something so horrible and demeaning as a crucifixion. Okay.
What?
Nope, sorry.
What are these?
Sorry.
At the end of all the drops of blood, do you know? The Holy Spirit? I mean, I've tried to zoom in on that, so this
I don't
is now.
Do you know? Yeah. Anybody?
Anyway.
It is
blood,
but then it,
spurting, but there's this little,
but then it does
pieces in this mosaic. Anyway, my guess would be representing the Holy,
Holy
Spirit,
Spirit
or something like that. I don't know if there was a got all these new words for me, Cumbie. I thought maybe it's a word. That's called the Harkin.
Okay, so here we are now in the medieval period. This is at a church that's in western France, St. Pierre Moissac. This is the vision that you were talking about in Revelation 4 of the 24 music-making elders. Christ is represented in this mandorla, which is intentionally this idea of this holy sphere that is around him that sometimes, oftentimes, maybe look like a boat. The church oftentimes is understood as a boat. That's why we call it a nave. But here he's got the vision of the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke here. And then these two angels that are very elongated, they have the scrolls of those that are going to be reviewed, the chosen and the damned. And then you have all of these wonderful figures. Okay, so if you're this represents the reason I chose this is it represents a style that emerges in Europe around 1000. Lots of the artwork of this time period were really looking at the Second Coming because like when we were going through the phase of 1999 to 2000, everybody thought that that might be the end of the world. So the same thing was going on 999 to 1000. And so you do have a lot of these images of the Second Coming. But these artists, this particular artist, whoever, we don't know the name of this, whoever this artist was, is not coming from a Greco-Roman tradition. They're coming from a Germanic tradition, which did not have this physical, humanitarian, humanistic representation of a classical body. They were really calligraphic. If you look at German early manuscript paintings, they're very frenetic. The lines are really, it's not the classical calm. It's not intended to be. And so, but this is representative of a style that comes into existence at this point in time. That's the first pan-European, non-Roman, I guess the Romans would call it barbaric, because everybody that wasn't Roman was barbarian. So it was the first pan-European style. So you'll see work like this that's in Italy and Spain, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Northern Italy, even in the Gothic and the Romanesque time period. That so it combines the Byzantine. They're looking at the Byzantine with this Germanic type of calligraphic, frenetic, very kind of evocative, emotionally evocative in terms of the way that they're turning. These things are actually coming from Rome. And then this is actually coming from kind of Islamic type of decor, because the Islamic people of the Muslim faith were at this point in Spain. And this is the beginning of the Crusades. And so the Christians and the Muslims will be in conflict with one another. And through that, the Christians will now become reacquainted with classicism. And that is the reason why we have the Renaissance. So Muslim, but also there's a slight pointed arch that is also an Islamic architectural innovation that will actually spearhead the Gothic movement.
Do you have any idea what the scale of that is?
The scale of this? Mm-hmm. It's over a door. So it's from, okay, so from me to Gil, like from me to Gil, and then probably up to the ceiling. So it's large. Okay, so now I'm going into what the title of this. I have 12 minutes left. Oh Lord. Okay, so I'm going to go fast. Okay, so now I'm going to go into the slides that y'all are probably confirmed. I know. Okay, this is a Duccio. Duccio is a Sienese artist. This was a painting that was commissioned by, it was on a huge altarpiece that was commissioned by the cathedral in Siena. And this was actually something that was done on the back of it. It's called a predella, where an artist oftentimes would do some experimentation. But this is Christ coming in to Jerusalem. Duccio is still got his foot in the Byzantine. It's called Italo-Byzantine style. So he's still using a lot of gold. It's erratic. It's all over the place. There's a lot of activity. It's not that everything coming together to create this united whole of a classical art, of classical piece. Okay, then we come to this. Leonardo da Vinci, everybody's very familiar with this piece. This is 1485. It was painted for a refectory in Milan at Santa Maria del Grazie. And da Vinci was innovative because he actually put all the disciples on one side of the table so that, you know, we are actually kind of participating in it as viewers. And also that it's a moment in time. It's once Christ had said, you know, within the next 24 hours, you will, someone will betray me. And everyone is asking, is it I? Is it I? Is it I? But Leonardo da Vinci, being a Renaissance artist, they have redone these classical components. So this is really based on pagan models. It has the commensurability of parts. It's using linear perspective at this point, which had been devised. But if you look at the head of Christ, it is being constructed using that ratio of proportion that's called the golden mean. So, sorry, we're running out of time because Gil has something he wants to do. Okay, so I have brought in some more modern pieces as well. I chose, this is by Emil Nold, who is a German artist, German expressionist artist. This was done in 1907. You can probably imagine people were really not very happy with this image. But I think that not only does it have the luminosity of a stained glass window, but the colors are so acidic and painful that I think that it really gets to sort of the heart of the betrayal and the agony of what Christ was enduring at this moment in time. So that's the reason why I chose this particular painting. You wanna say anything?
Okay. No. It's evocative.
Okay, and then I chose, this is a William Blake. Y'all may know of William Blake as a writer, poet. He was part of the Romantic movement. And in this particular image, he was a self-taught painter. So this was painted on tin, which is mounted on some steel. So it's got this sort of luminosity because of that. But I chose this image, this coming from the Gospel of Luke, where Luke talks about there is an angel that comes and consoles Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. So that is what is, he's this tenderness between the angel and Christ here. And then back in this distance are the disciples. And they literally look like monsters, the way that he has betrayed, that he's done it. And then here, you've got these linear lines that are actually going into the hands of Christ. So that is, evoking.
Luke is the only gospel that gives the detail that Christ sweated blood. So this is the same sort of intensity. Luke wants to make sure we have that. He's the only one that adds that an angel is coming. And then this is just a comment. Whatever's going on here is just compelling.
This light.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But from the inside out, the viscera, as it were, of the angel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a ministering agent, and there's just the cross, and there's just
Anyway. Where does this piece live now?
You know, it's in really bad condition. I'm not exactly sure where it's living. I can look it up for you, Beth. Okay, and then this is a well-known painting by Giotto, who oftentimes is considered to be the father of Western painting because he reinvigorates the style, Greco-Roman style, that the Italians had sources in Pompeii that they could see, or probably they were not uncovered Pompeii, but in Roman villas and et cetera, that they could see. So it is fresco, and this is in a private chapel. So it was commissioned by a specific individual, which is also something that is coming away from the hierarchy of the church that you get. And he's treating painting like a stage, so that you have figures that are cut off. You have this, he uses color to bring the attention. It's this commensurability of parts, all things coming together to create this united whole that I've talked about. Gill is seeing this painting as really violent, the way that these sticks are going through. This is in the intimacy of Judas and the kiss and the heightened sense of the betrayal because of the intimacy of that.
I mean, even the bridegroom image or idea, which some have picked up on with Judas and Jesus, you know, a bride and a groom beneath the covers, wrapped and enveloped. I mean, the nearness of the betrayal with something as intimate as a kiss, and just all that violent contrast. That's what I was kind of with. And I'd never seen this, and this is one of the three or four that kind of have piqued me more than any. And here's Peter cutting off the ear of Malchus, for instance. I mean, the violence, and just knowing what's coming, it just makes me weep a little bit.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Oh, this is a great one.
It's Germanic.
Yeah, okay. My name is Crocky.
So this is The Suicide of Judas, and it actually is by an artist who's known, Gis Libertus, who's a Romanesque artist, and this is at St. Lazare, or it's a church that's dedicated to Lazarus. There's some of his bones, relics that are there that you can go. But I love the way that, okay, so this is, again, a Germanic person who's coming out, not from this tradition of this classical physical body, but because of that, in its own right, the Germans are able to get at this intense emotionality that Gill is drawn to. And it's coming from, you know, this old tradition that they believed, the Germans before Christianity believed that the woods, the trees were actually inhabited by spirits. And so that's kind of these gargoyles and grotesques coming from that mind frame of the German past. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
Okay. The Denial of Peter. I just loved this image because of, and this is by a Dutch painter of the 17th century in the Golden Age, von Hanthorst. I just loved his face, the way the image of Peter. It's completely guilty, but yet he is denying, and the the disbelief of the man that is behind him. It's like, yeah, you're not. So,
who's the figure within all the light?
That is the maid servant who came and asked him a number of times.
Mm-hmm. A girl.
A girl.
Just a girl.
Just a girl.
Just a girl.
Peter was given up because of his accent. Like, you're from the South. I can hear it. You're from Galilee. I can hear it in your accent. He was a girl.
Okay, I can't believe that I'm running out of time like this.
Okay,
so I'm going to go quickly because I really want to get to our window.
We'll make a series.
Okay, so, but this particular painting, I chose this because it definitely gets to the agony. I mean, there's a Caravaggio flagellation, but, you know, the Italian master, his body's beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not this agony, and I also love the way that this actually pushes the figure of Christ into you. Like you are standing in it, as well as This is a Rual, modern artist. I also think as a modern artist, he's using the material of paint, the materiality of paint, to actually get at the agony or the dripping, the emotion of Christ himself. 1905, wow. George Rual. And then this is a Quentin Messens, and he was the master of Antwerp, so he also, you know, was very well known, but is definitely looking at some of the Renaissance perspective. But again, we are put in the crowd. This is currently in the Prado, but we're looking at we are in the crowd, and this man is kind of looking over at the viewer and saying, so what do you think? You know, it's like, should we, and are you okay with this? And then I also love Pontius Pilate, because if you could zoom in and see the details of it, it's just his whole demeanor is that he's completely uncomfortable with the decision that has been made. And he seems to be without, like he's been pushed into the situation. And the ugliness of the people that are surrounding, as well as in this particular image, which is from the school of Hieronymus Bosch, with Christ carrying the cross. Simon of Cyrene is this figure that is here. This is the one of the
impotent thief.
Impotent and then impudent. And then this is the
penitent
thief.
I couldn't understand what you just said.
The two thieves.
The thief on the cross who said, you know,
forgive me.
Yeah, forgive me, have mercy. Today you'll see me in paradise. And the one that didn't.
That said, you know, you can save yourself.
We'll talk about this when we do this again.
Okay.
There's a lot.
There's a lot. And then this is the raising of the cross by Rembrandt. And Rembrandt, as a Protestant, was really identifying with the the event of what's going on. So he literally places himself. This is him in a painter's beret. This right here is actually a painter's tool that you would rest your arm on. And then Nicodemus is back here, which I would have to venture to say it's also a portrait
right.
of Rembrandt as well, yep. because it looks very similar to some of the self-portraits. Rembrandt has many, many, many self-portraits, but it's very Protestant because he's putting himself in it, and it's very intimate. All right. Crucifixion. This is Velázquez, Spanish master of the 17th century. This was painted directly after the time that he was in Rome, where he met with the Pope. Y'all probably know that image of Innocent X. That's very well known. And so this is a very classically informed body of Christ. It's very calm. It's very quiet. It's very beautiful versus this one, which is from a German hand, Matthias Grunewald, and it is from the Isenheim altarpiece, where Christ's body is completely torn up and agonized with these hands. Grunewald was an incredible colorist. This was executed for a hospital where people were suffering from that was called ergot's disease, which caused the flesh to decay and gangrene to come in, and so they would oftentimes amputate parts of it. And so this is a direct appeal to the people that were looking at this. This is part of something that's called Christian humanism, where the artists of this time period, with Luther, this man was sympathetic to the teachings of Luther, that Christian humanism, that they were really focusing on the physical humanity of Christ, really different from the classically informed crucifixions that I showed you with Velázquez. So I'm in lieu of time, I'm going to switch to our window.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Oops, I'm going backwards. So I'm going to, sorry, y'all, but I'm going to switch up to.
This is what you got to look for next. It's going to be next.
Okay. I just wanted to talk about this window because it's ours and we live with this piece of art. I love the windows. I sit and look at this this window like all the time, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the heck was this artist doing with this color right here? And you then begin to see it throughout. There's this compositional integrity that is absolutely incredible with these pieces. But with a little research, I found out that this was actually part of a school from Munich that is called the Franz Mayer School from Munich. It is still intact today. It's run by the fifth generation of that specific family. They're still making stained glass, but they're also doing collaborations with contemporary artists like George Baslitz, Ellsworth Kelly. So it is it's a functioning studio. But we have five of these windows, and they are created using a method which is mouth-blown stained glass, which is hand-painted, and they're large panes of glass. So it's very different from some of the other ones that are more medieval, that are really small, fragmented things. But all of, like, this drapery, all of that are really hand-painted. But if you look at this image of Christ, I hope that after this class, now you can see that this is a Christ that is classically informed. Okay, this is a very peaceful Christ. And I'm really grateful for that, because I don't know that I would want to stand under the Isenheim altarpiece every Sunday and look at that. But it is such a beautiful, coloristically, if you look at the way these different variations and the colors that are being done by the artist, there's these subtle, you know, all the different blues. And if you look at this blood red, that is actually created in stained glass by adding gold to the molten sand. And so that creates that blood. And then, they're using different types of cobalt also to create these blues as well. But I just think we're very fortunate to have five windows by this group. The other ones are the North Transept, which is the Life of Christ and the Transfiguration. There's the Good Samaritan window, the Calling of the Disciples, which is on the north wall. And then at the very back of our church, on the western wall, there's five windows that are the four evangelists and the Holy Spirit that's in the middle of those. And those are all done by this very well-known stained glass studio in Munich, Germany. It is finished, is what is held up here. Why did Christ die? In John Harper's book, he points out that Christ is the why here. And then there is, the question is, why did Christ die? And it's why, O, and then U in terms of the shape of the figures there. But that was John Harper. I don't know. Anyway, we're very lucky to have this. I'm sorry that I had to go rush through here. I was sure that I would be able to get through all the images. I can show you real quick.
Thank you for coming, for the waiting.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.